2 weeks ago, we finished a three-part series, How to Quit Complaining. And then last week, we were in Los Angeles doing the Ramayana for the grand Diwali Mela there on Excelsior High School in Pioneer Boulevard. And this week, we're back, and we're starting a new series called Peaceful Under Pressure. We're a little late starting it because I had to send it to myself and download it, so I'll be 10 minutes shorter than I usually am. You know, it's easy to be peaceful when things are going our way. The real test is when things are not going our way, whether we can maintain our composure, whether we can be strong under stress, peaceful under pressure, or calm in a crisis. Arjuna, the person to whom the Bhagavad Gita, the song of God, was spoken by Lord Krishna 5,000 years ago, he wasn't exactly a wilting lily. He was a very, very powerful warrior. He'd fought dozens of battles against thousands of men. He'd conquered many of the great heroes of his day. So he was used to circumstances and situations which would have completely unmanned most of us. He was far out ahead of us in terms of being peaceful under pressure. He lived on the edge. He was a warrior. He put his life on the line every day against skilled, lethal opponents like Bhisma, Dronacharya, Karna, Duryodhana, Ashwatthama. So he was used to that. We could hardly ourselves in this modern world imagine the kinds of pressures under which Arjuna was subjected on a day-by-day basis. But when the Bhagavad Gita came up, something totally unique, even to Arjuna, presented itself to him. He had to fight. Well, that's okay. Been there, done that. No problem there. He had to fight a great war. He'd fought many great wars. He had to fight formidable opponents. He'd fought many formidable opponents. But on this occasion, there was an extra ingredient which he'd never seen before. On the opposing side, amongst the formidable warriors, who were wrongdoers, there's no question about that. They were in the wrong, and Arjuna was in the right. But the twist of fate was that opposing Arjuna were his teachers, his cousins, and his brothers. And that he had never seen before. So he was being pushed beyond his limits. And Krishna was there to help him out. It says two are better than one. Two are better than one because if one falls, then the other one can pick him up. So Arjuna is in he's in a situation where he can either fall or he can go to an entirely new and higher level of realization and surrender. And Krishna is there as his friend and as his teacher to take him there. To take him perhaps where no man has ever gone before. And it's an internal space. We're not talking about the external space. So this is a series called How to Be Peaceful Under Pressure. And it's all based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder and Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Now, what to speak of the kind of pressures Arjuna was under. I've done a number of weddings. In fact, in Vernal, we have a wedding on Wednesday. You'd hardly think a wedding would be an occasion for that much nervousness, but you'd be surprised sometimes what people say in weddings. One time, a man, during the kanyadan, the giving away of the daughter, the husband said, my mother and I give our daughter away. A little bit of a misspoken there, and boy, did he get a look from his mother. No. Another priest who must have been a little nervous, maybe it was first or second wedding, he referred to the bride as the awfully wedded wife. Another social worker was haranguing a big crowd, you see, haranguing them and telling people, he was asking people, do you realize that every year in this country 300,000 babies are born illiterate? Like this billboard, illiterate, right for free help. How to be peaceful under pressure. Arjuna felt he couldn't go either way. He didn't see how any good would come if he fought, and he couldn't see how any good would come if he didn't fight. Because even though his opponents were his teachers, his relatives, and friends, They were espousing the cause of repression and tyranny. And if Arjuna abdicated the battlefield, they would just sashay right into the world government and cause all kinds of havoc. So he was darned if he did, and he was darned if he didn't. He was under a lot of pressure, just like this guy who doesn't seem to be able to go backwards, and he doesn't seem to be able to comfortably go forwards. Or these fish that are in the Vita mix here, the Vita blend. And the one is saying, I can't stand the tension. So when you're in the Vita blend, you see, can you hack it, you see? Can you deal with the tension? When we come out of the womb of our mother, we're coming into a totally strange, alien world. Everything sets our nerves on edge. Everything causes apprehension. The questions, the big ontological questions we have, newly emerging into the light. Is there safety here in this place to which I've arrived? Is there happiness here in this place to which I've arrived? Is there peace here in this place to which I arrived? And the answer, throughout ages and ages and ages, is contained within the sacred syllable that the great sages and yogis have intoned since time immemorial. Om Tad Vishnu Padamam Padam, Om Asato Matsagamaya, Om Sri Govinda, Sri Govinda, Sri Govinda. That word Om contains the answers to all those questions of the newborn baby. Yes, the Om tells us there is safety. Yes, the Om tells us there is happiness. Yes, the Om tells us there is peace. The Om floods the mind with peace. Mounted at the entrance to most temples in India is a bell, such as the bell you see there. And people ring it one time. Now, you ladies, one time, not many times, and not right in the middle of the lecture, okay? Take notes here. Because by ringing it one time, go ahead and ring it one time, Hanuman, and listen to this. You hear that? Om, Om. People ring the bell when they enter the temple because it gives them peace. They leave their hypertensions, they leave their trivial concerns at the door so they can enjoy the eternal atmosphere of the temple. And I've often wondered, you know, when we say that English word home, gotta go home, home. There's just something super comforting, super peaceful, super happy about saying home, isn't it? And I always just sort of wondered whether it doesn't have something to do with the fact that it contains om in it. We have baseball caps downstairs, which we sell, and they have the Om symbol on them. And I tell people that when you are the proud owner of this baseball cap and you are sporting on your head, you are on the Om team. Many, many thousands of years ago, a king named Prichinibarisha talked to a sage called Narada Muni about how to deal with pressure, how to deal with crises. And the advice that Narada Muni gave to the king was, those who are interested only in a so-called beautiful life, namely remaining as a householder entangled by sons and a wife and searching after wealth, they think that such things are life's ultimate goal. Such people simply wander in different types of bodies throughout this material existence without finding out the ultimate goal of life. See, we're here. We're in this temporary world, this dark world. Look out the window. This is a dark world. This is a temporary world. It is a world of birth, death, disease, and old age. When we cleaned out the pavilion the other day, we had our Diwali celebration, and a big part of it was going to be in the pavilion. So we cleaned it, Radha Krishna steam sprayed it, we swept it, and then we had to close the glass windows because we didn't want the peacocks to go in and mess it all up again, okay? Well, we didn't know it, but there were four little sparrows that had gotten inside it. And we closed it and we went away, and those sparrows, we found their bodies on the inside, you see, because they had tried to fly out and then they had broken their necks against the clear glass window. So it's sad, but at the same time, life is fragile. Who can deny it? Who can actually say that they're guaranteed another 50 or 40 or 30 years or even 50 minutes of life? We have got this particular body in this present world of birth, death, disease, and all, because in our previous life, we were materially attached. In our previous life, we didn't concern ourselves with the eternal. We didn't concern ourselves with mukti. We didn't concern ourselves with escaping this world and going to the world of birth and death. And because we didn't concern ourselves in that way, our consciousness remained colored by material appetites, desires, and ambitions. So that at the time of death, when we left the previous bodies, we had that aroma, we had that fragrance, we had that consciousness. And because it was material, we got another material body, we took another incarnation, we remained in samsara to fulfill the plans that were unfulfilled in our previous life. That's how we got here. Every one of us took birth, and every one of us is going to die. And prior to that is going to be old age and disease. So consider that if you got here because of being too much involved in temporal things like friends, family, and country, consider that if you don't extricate yourself in this life, you're going to come back. You're going to come back. You don't get to the spiritual world with material consciousness. I'm sorry. It doesn't happen by wishful thinking. It happens, you go to the spiritual world by having a spiritualized consciousness. It is said that the price one pays for the ticket to go to the spiritual world are the tears of eagerness that one sheds to have it. So what do you shed tears of eagerness about? Does anything push your buttons? Is there anything you'd really like to have so much you'd taste it? Is there anything you'd like to have so much you'd cry for it? And if so, is that thing, is that ambition, is that target, is that goal to reunite with God and go back and live with Him? And I doubt it. I doubt it. I doubt it. I think even religious people are more interested in football. They're more interested in hunting. They're more interested in going to the show on Saturday night. They're more interested in a raise in salary. They're more interested in what the Cougars' schedule is going to be. I see all kinds of people, and I don't hardly see anybody who's going to cry for God. When Prabhupada gave us this mantra in the 60s, when he came in 1965, and he started this whole Hare Krishna movement on this one principle, 400 temples, thousands and thousands of people, and we're all based on one principle, how to cry to God. This is the university of how to cry to God. This is not the university to learn internet technology. This is not the university to learn law. This is not the university to learn medicine. This is not the university to learn anything material. Because of material preoccupations, we're here now. And we want to get out of this. This is the university of how to cry for God. And we've got 400 campuses all over the world. And the mechanism, the technique is chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now anyone can chant Hare Krishna. And because it's absolute, the name of the Lord and the Lord are non-different. In the relative world, the name of something and the thing itself are different. If I say water, 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 I'll still be thirsty because the name water and the substance are different. But on the absolute platform, the Lord and His name are non-different. So anyone who chants even once or hears even once is eternally benefited. Those of you who are students who come not necessarily willingly, but because it's a class assignment, or maybe you're just mildly inquisitive, or maybe you're even derisory, let's go to the Hare Krishnas and have a good laugh. Still, just coming here for an hour and hearing the mantra, hearing the philosophy, the benefit is eternal. There is a deposit in your eternal bank account which will never be atrophied, which will never be eroded. Anyone can benefit. Anyone can chant. Okay? But the university of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness and its branches and campuses all over the world are to learn how to do it daily, systematically, and to learn how to do it heartfeltedly. To chant heartfeltedly. Because when one chants the names of God, and we don't insist on Krishna, if you come from a different tradition and you have a different name for God like Elohim or Allah, then chant that. Work on it. Make it your highest, most important priority in life if you don't want to come back here. Learn how to chant any bona fide name of God with heart feeling. And when you cry tears of separation while chanting God's names, when the hair on the back of your neck stands on end, when you get goosebumps all over your body, when you feel that even every moment that you remain separated from God seems like 12 years or more, then you are eligible for liberation. That in the very, very near future, such a person who is hankering on that level is going to find themselves back home in the eternal spiritual world. And that was Narada Muni's advice to Prichinibharisha. Now, Prichinibharisha, like any father, he had sons. His sons were named Prajetas. And his ambition was for his sons to get married and raise a family. There's nothing wrong with temporal ambitions. Nothing wrong with marriage, nothing wrong with a family, with kids, with having some money in the bank, with being employed. The wrongness is you get too attached. You take it as all in all. It occupies the central position in your heart. These things are meant to be around the edge, and God is meant to be in the center. God is not meant to be a resident in your heart. He's meant to be the president of your heart. So the problem is we get too attached to these things. We take them as all in all. So Prichinibharisha, like any father, he wanted material prosperity, material family for his kids. But he did not want them to get stuck. And so he asked Narada Muni, what should I do? How can I train my sons before marriage? Because obviously marriage is going to be a lot more pressure than single life. Anyone argue with that? Any argument? Any arguments? When we're single, you know, footloose and fancy free, you know. A single person, you know, they can lose their job. It's no big deal. I'll get another one. Right? Right? Single person can take off time, go backpacking. Single person can have a health crisis and recover and bounce back from it and just be as good or even better than ever. But when you're married, there's a lot of pressure that comes with the territory. You know, it's a much more serious thing if you lose your job. It's much more difficult to take time off. It takes a lot of planning to pull that off, you know. And your health, not just your well-being, but the well-being of your wife and your kids, all rest on your health. And you can't always find time to go to the gym and go work, and you can't always eat right. And so your lifestyle itself, the responsibilities that weigh on your shoulder, sometimes keep you from doing those things which you would normally do to keep in good health. And it can become a vicious circle. So Prichinibharisha wanted the best of both worlds for his son. He wanted them to marry, have children, support them, but he wanted them to be free from anxiety and pressure. He wanted them to be peaceful under pressure. So Narada Muni said, if before they get married, you can resolve four issues, you can bring about the resolution of four issues for your sons, they can go into any situation and be peaceful. Just like ultimately Arjuna, he was full of anxiety, he was not peaceful under the pressure of having to kill his teachers and his relatives, but after Krishna walked him through the Bhagavad Gita, in the 700 verses of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna dealt with these four issues, he resolved these issues, at the end of which Arjuna was peaceful under pressure and he agreed to fight. What are those four issues? The issue of identity, the issue of responsibility, the issue of priority, and the issue of difficulty. These are the four issues that if we resolve them, we'll always be peaceful no matter what the provocation. Here is a quote from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And these are the Prachetas, and they're traveling to a place where they're going to do penances and austerities and prepare themselves morally for building their character before they undertake the responsibility of parenthood and family life. So they're traveling looking for a secluded place, and they come upon a natural spot which seems to reflect their ambition. And what is that natural spot? It's a great lake. And here it's described. While traveling, the Prachetas happened to see a great reservoir of water, which seemed almost as big as the ocean. The water of this lake was so calm and quiet that it seemed like the mind of a great soul. And its inhabitants, the aquatics, appeared very peaceful and happy to be under the protection of such a watery reservoir. Purcheta thought, this is the place. This is the place where we make our stand, we form our characters before we go and throw ourselves into the business of life. This is what we want to be like. We want to be deep, we want to be calm, we want to be dislodged. You see, a little drop of water on the surface of the lake can be affected by the pounding heat of the sun and evaporated and extracted from the lake. But those aquatics who have assumed their forms and who live deep in the lake, they can never be dislodged. They can never be extracted from the lake. So they asked, they prayed for that kind of a form, that kind of consciousness, which is deep and full and solidly situated. And here is the mentality of an eternally liberated soul. If you pay lip service, if you aspire to go to the spiritual world, what you're basically aspiring for is to have a siddha sarup. This form that we have now is not siddha. This is not a perfect form that we have. This flesh and bones and mucus and bile. This form which covers our soul is imperfect because it is the result of imperfect consciousness from a previous life. Therefore, it's subject to birth, death, disease, and old age, hunger, and thirst, and so on and so forth. So just as our mentality from a previous life resulted in this imperfect body, if we rectify our mentality and follow the advice of great saints and sages like Narada Muni, we'll get pure, fragrant, sinless, unpolluted mentality. And then that mentality will manifest itself in this kind of a body, the Siddha Sarup. Siddha means perfect and Sarup means form. The perfect form which is free from birth, from death, from disease, and from old age. So that's preceded by pure consciousness. And what is the characteristic? Here it is described. A devotee's mind is very calm, quiet, and desireless because he is always anya bilasita sunya, having no desire other than to serve Krishna or God, serve him as a servant, serve him as a friend, serve him as a father, serve him as a mother, or serve him as a conjugal lover. These are the four broad general categories of ras, or mellow, or relationships which liberated souls have with God. Either neutrality, servitorship, friendship, parenthood, or conjugal lover. These are the five rasas that one has in the liberated state. Due to his association with Krishna, a devotee is always very calm and cool. It is also significant that within that reservoir, all the aquatics were very calm and quiet. One of our biggest problems is the age in which we live. You know, if you go out in a rainstorm, you're going to get wet, right? If you hang around a barber shop, you're going to get a haircut sooner or later. If you lie down with dogs, you're going to get fleas. If you go to prison, oftentimes even innocent people are sent to prison, but because of their association with the criminals, they come out with a criminal mentality. So one of the problems is the age in which we're living. This is called the age of Kali Yuga. It's the age of anxiety. And it wasn't always the case. We go through certain seasons cosmically. First season is the golden age. People are free of anxiety. They're yogis. They live in the forest and they do penances and austerities and yoga. There's no cities. There's no currency. Then the next age is called the Treta Age, and that's the Silver Age. And anxiety begins to manifest itself, but it's very less. Most people are free from anxiety. Then the Bronze Age is follows then, called the Dwarpa Age. And then it's about half and half. Some peace and some anxiety. But now Kali Yuga, it's all anxiety. It's all anxiety. Hardly in a million people you won't find even one person who's peaceful. And if they're peaceful, it's just because everything happens to be going their way at the moment. But their peace is destined to be shattered in the very, very near future. Do we agree that most people are uptight? Uptight, was that even a word 50 years ago? Could you even find that word in the dictionary 50 years ago? You know, words come into being because of usage, you see what I'm saying? So if people were more relaxed 50 or 60 years ago, there was no occasion for calling, man, you're uptight, chill out, cool out, you know. It seems to be getting worse because we have the emergence of words like this, uptight, nervous, irritable, and tense, you see. A gun called tension. A gun called tension. Tension kills more people than all the wars of the world, than all the guns and all the bombs and all the mines. More people are killed by tension than by any other cause. Any other cause. Heart attacks are at all time high, and they result from high blood pressure, from stress and tension. Number one cause of death is heart attacks. Number one cause of heart attacks is tension. People take $500 million worth of tranquilizers annually just to drop themselves into emotionally lower gears. Here's a little cartoon I found. Here's Michelangelo painting Mona Lisa. And the model has this goofy ear-to-ear smile. And Michelangelo says, I preferred it before you started taking Prozac. If they had Prozac back in those days, we wouldn't have the Mona Lisa painting. So unresolved issues. If you go to work, you go to school, and your family, if you have someone with whom you have an unresolved issue, it ruins your day. It makes your day go tense. You taste salt in your mouth, sand underneath your tongue. Until you talk it out with that family member or that co-worker, until you sit down and say, well, I meant this, and I'm sorry, I apologize. And you get the air cleared. Have you ever heard that term? Clear the air. Until you do that, you can't be peaceful. So we need to resolve certain issues. There might be decisions that you're agonizing over. Should I continue dating this girl when my mom doesn't like her? Should I continue in this job that pays good, but it's killing me? I hate it. There's something else I could do. I could have a lot more fun, but it would be half the pay. You know, we're all wrestling with decisions like this, and until we resolve them, we're not going to be peaceful. Life is best lived by great principles than petty rules. You know, in scriptures, you have lots of thou shalt nots. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not disrespect thy father and mother. That's not how life is supposed to be lived. Life is not a minefield that we go tippy-toeing through. Anyway, there's no such thing as a negative in nature. There's no such thing as a not in nature. Someone says, there's not any gas in my tank. But there's air in your tank. There's air. There may not be gas in your tank, but there's air in your tank. So you can't not do something. You can only not do something if you're doing something else better. That's how you don't do this, you do this better. You don't not do something. It's impossible. However, if there's an unwanted habit that's causing you stress and tension, and you find something more satisfying, then you'll not do the things that cause tension and pressure. So life is not lived by petty little rules. It's lived by great, great principles. And right decisions are made based on right principles when we look at life from the right point of view and deal with the right issues. When we assume that kind of responsibility, we can remain calm under pressure and get peace of mind, calm in a crisis, and strong under stress. Otherwise, our destiny is to be Ashanta. You might have attended the ceremony that we had earlier today, and we did the fire sacrifice, we did the havan, and we asked everyone to chant Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti on five different occasions. Shanti is a Sanskrit word for peace. But if you don't live your life based on positives, on great virtues, on great spiritual transcendental aspirations, then you'll not know peace. You'll not know peace. Arjuna had a choice of fighting a battlefield based on a great principle, the preservation of religiosity and piety, and the annihilation of the mistress. That was the principle that he had as an option. The other principle was not to shed blood, to abdicate the battlefield and go and be a yogi and meditate. And initially, he thought he would be more peaceful going to a quiet spot where there's lakes and breezes and swans and lotus flowers and meditating. And he thought, how can I be peaceful by fighting? But Krishna, during the course of the Bhagavad Gita, explained to Arjuna that we become peaceful not by doing nothing, but we become peaceful by dedicating ourselves to great principles and great purposes. And that's how we become peaceful, even in the midst of a battlefield. And being uncommitted and unresolved, you could be in the most beautiful, idyllic vacation hermitage spot in the world, and you'll be totally ashanti, totally without peace, totally disturbed, and totally in anxiety. It is stated, Krishna Bhakta Nishkama, those who are devoted to the Lord and to the works of the Lord, those who know the mind of the Lord, and who work as partners with the Lord to spread the teachings of the Lord, to awaken people to God consciousness, and to canvas to bring them back home, back to the transcendental world, those people are peaceful, even if they happen to be fighting a battle in the course of executing their mission. Because for themselves, they have no ambitions or desires. Their purpose is in fulfilling the desires of the Lord. We're not self-created, we're created by God. And God created us for a purpose, and the only way you're going to know peace is to find out what that purpose is and fulfill it. There's no other way to achieve peace. Otherwise it says, Ataiva Shanta Bhukti Mukti Siddhi Kamila Shakale Ashanta. Those who want to enjoy the temporary things of this material world, they are without peace. Those who want salvation, there are people that do their hallelujahs and hosannas and all, and their purpose is to get salvation for themselves, to get shut of all the misery and tribulations of this material world and go to a vacation rest spot. You see what I'm saying? They'll not know peace either, because it's about them and their salvation. And even Siddhi Kami, those yogis who aspire for mystic perfections, they'll also not know peace as much as those who are engaged in the service of the Lord. So we're going to wind it up here for part one. We've given you the introduction. We've told you the four issues that we're going to be talking about: identity, responsibility, difficulty, and one other. We've set the scene. Preaching Abharshad has sent his sons out. The Prachetas have gone out. They've found a great lake by the side of which they're going to do penances and austerities. And as they're girding themselves for household life, as they're preparing themselves and building their characters, enter into the arena of life and live in the world, but not of the world, to maintain a family and execute all those responsibilities, and at the same time come out on the other side of that and go back home, back to Godhead, and benedict their loved ones in the same way, as all this is being set, what we're going to start with next week is the great devotee of Lord Krishna, Lord Shiva, comes to them in that secluded spot and helps them to resolve those issues of identity, responsibility, and difficulty, much in the same way that Krishna helped Arjuna resolve those same four issues during the course of hearing the Bhagavad Gita. So we'll finish there, and as we always do, if you'd like to join us, chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.